Was, wenn es unbegrenzt viele Arbeitskräfte gäbe? In jedem Unternehmen gibt es häufig mehr Arbeit als verfügbare Ressourcen. Mit Agentforce können Unternehmen KI-Agenten einsetzen, die nahtlos mit Menschen zusammenarbeiten, um Kundenerfolg und starke Beziehungen zu fördern. Diese KI-Agenten unterstützen ihre KundInnen rund um die Uhr, agieren eigenständig und übergeben komplexere Aufgaben reibungslos an MitarbeiterInnen. Erfahren Sie mehr auf salesforce.com/de. Agentforce. KI, wie sie schon immer sein sollte.
All engine running. Absolute genius.
Get this.
Welcome.
This is the show where we bring you
science.
What that essentially means is
discovery,
advances,
questions,
research,
technology.
Unbelievable.
Without further ado,
this is The Naked Scientists.
Hello, welcome to the Naked Scientist podcast. This is the program that brings you the biggest breakthroughs and talks to the major movers and shakers from the worlds of science, technology, and medicine. I'm Chris Smith. Coming up, it is 5 years since COVID began and the WHO hosted their first press conference on the virus. But how much have we learned since, and are we prepared for the next pandemic? Also, a report from the UK House of Lords points to a rapidly closing window of opportunity to capitalise on engineering biology. But what exactly is that? And is there a hidden planet lurking out beyond Pluto? A new telescope will soon enable astronomers to find out.
From Cambridge University's Institute of Continuing Education, this is The Naked Scientists.
Up first this week, it's unlikely that COVID-19 will still make top billing on news bulletins. But almost exactly 5 years ago this week, the pandemic was beginning to unfold in front of our eyes. And we're still living with the consequences. It's estimated that COVID claimed as many as 20 million lives and caused widespread mental health problems in the aftermath, keeping more than 1 billion children out of the classroom. It also hammered the global economy. The World Health Organization's acting director in the Department of Epidemic and Pandemic Threat Management, Maria van Kerkhove, has just published a comment in the journal Science, reminding us that COVID and the threat of future pandemics hasn't gone away.
5 years ago, we first heard of this. You know, WHO first learned of this cluster of pneumonia of unknown etiology. And yesterday, the 14th of January, was the date of my first ever press conference. I thought it would be my first and my last. And I actually found the video online. I tweeted it yesterday. At the time, there were 41 confirmed cases. But by that time, WHO, we had already set up an incident management team. We had already notified our member states. We were communicating regularly with our member states, either through our official channels and through the international health regulations or publicly. We published an entire package of technical guidance for what we were calling nCoV, for a novel coronavirus, later to be known as SARS-CoV-2 and later to be called COVID-19. We had already published the first PCR assay. I mean, we were full force in full swing.
If we look at the numbers now, where are we? Cases, area under the curve since then, how many people have actually succumbed to this thing? Put us in the picture and where we've got to 5 years on.
5 years on, there have been billions of infections. You know, we now have a new birth cohort of children from 0 to 4 years old, you know, who have a different immune profile, different exposure to this virus. But almost everyone on the planet has been exposed and arguably infected. In terms of deaths, reported deaths are just over 7 million, but we don't have full visibility on how many people have died from COVID. We estimate that it's at least three times higher. But the estimates that we had when we were doing excess mortality are basically from the first 2 years. We're actually undergoing an exercise now to look at deaths from the third and the fourth year of the pandemic. So we don't actually have an accurate measure of the true impact of COVID. And I want to be clear, I don't want to talk about COVID in the past. It's still circulating. It's still infecting. It's still killing. And I don't know, Chris, if you remember, at the peak of COVID, this was January 2021, before vaccinations were rolled out, before we really had effective treatments, about 100,000 deaths were reported each week. At the peak in terms of circulation, when Omicron hit in early 2022, reported cases each week were around 23.5 million. I mean, these are staggering numbers. And I think, you know, all of us who've gone through this, and I, you know, you and I had talked previously about just looking at the progression of age on our own faces, you know, over the course of the last 5 years. It's had a massive toll on everyone. This virus has impacted everyone. And for those people who've lost loved ones, they're still grieving. Those people who are dealing with acute disease, who are dealing with long COVID, this is not something that's in the past. And right now we have about 4,000 deaths per week. So it's not gone. It's just out of the headlines.
I was asked the other day, probably because of the anniversary, are we better prepared now? Are we in much better shape? So if COVID Mark II lands tomorrow, it will be a walk in the park in comparison. And I have to admit, I struggled to answer the question. And I think your own Director General, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said a similar sort of thing, didn't he? There have been things we have learned, but things we haven't.
Yeah, the answer is yes and no. You know, in many respects, we have the experience. We are better prepared because we've taken concrete measures within countries to improve surveillance systems, to increase diagnostic capacities, sequencing capacities, emergency operation centers, looking at the use of medical oxygen and sustaining the use of medical oxygen, clinical care, in some cases, better PPE. We need more work on ventilation, you know, but those systems have been investments, but we're also seeing a decline in the investment in those, in those systems. How can we maintain those for that next one? That it's not a matter of if, but when. We also have taken some concrete steps with regards to setting up within WHO, you know, hubs for supply chains to be able to better have those materials in locations around the world so that they can reach the people in need the most. We've been setting up access and allocation mechanisms using a medical countermeasures network at the direction of our member states to say, how do we better utilize the partnerships around the world to not just say we want equitable distribution of safe and effective diagnostics, therapeutics, vaccines, but how do we concretely do that? There's work on more mRNA hubs, technology hubs, tech transfer. But the question is how well we sustain this. So there have been concrete efforts to be better prepared the next time, not only to earlier detect, but to mitigate what may become a pandemic, if we can. But on the other hand, we're in a situation now where the world is very complex. We have huge numbers of emergencies that are climate related, war and displacement, earthquakes and floods. We have a geopolitical climate that is extremely complex. The politicization of everything, the threats on science, there's so much misinformation, disinformation. So the complexity of the environment in which we are dealing with these constant threats is incredibly difficult. So it's yes and it's no. And I think what we want to see is concerted investments strategically and sustained, like we see with, you know, the pandemic fund is another example of taking some concrete steps to have sustainable financing. And the negotiations of the pandemic accord by the member states is absolutely critical. We need something better than a handshake to say, you know, let's do better the next time. We need binding agreements between member states, driven by member states, and embedded within national laws to be able to say, you know what, we will do better the next time.
Maria van Kerkhove at the World Health Organization. And we'd be very interested, actually, to hear how you would have answered that question. Do you feel that the right lessons have been learned? And are we indeed in much better shape to defeat the next pandemic as a result? Tell us what you think. Meanwhile, here in the UK, our Prime Minister Keir Starmer has declared that artificial intelligence is the defining opportunity of modern times in a bid to put technology at the centre of our economic growth. But this comes as the UK's House of Lords is urging decision makers and big businesses to take bold steps to boost the country's biotech sector. Otherwise, they say, we risk being trapped in a doom loop where foreign competitors exploit British breakthroughs and leapfrog us economically. I've been speaking with Julia King, who's otherwise known as Baroness Brown of Cambridge. She chairs the Lords Science and Technology Committee.
The title of this report is Don't Fail to Scale, Seizing the Opportunity of Engineering Biology. Engineering biology is using organisms such as bacteria to replace industrial processes, particularly industrial chemistry. And it relies on the fact that we can now read DNA and actually, if you like, write DNA, create DNA sequences. So it uses things like gene editing, but also, very importantly, AI, because that gives us the ability to find and select, and indeed also to tailor biological organisms that can do particular jobs. And some of those jobs can be really important. So bacteria that can break down fatbergs to turn them into ingredients for perfume. Something terrible from the drains, turning it into something that we can make perfume out of.
I don't know. Some people have given me some fairly questionable aftershaves in the past, Julia, for Christmas. And it probably smells like it comes from that origin. But we've been doing this kind of thing, synthetic biology and so on, for many years. So why is this report coming out now, and what's new?
The UK, as you say, has been really brilliant at the science of synthetic biology, and kind of over the last 20 years we've been developing that science base, but now it's really starting to take off and become industrial processes, and industrial processes that could be much lower energy, that could be much more sustainable, less environmentally damaging, and could help us to really solve some of the world's big problems. And it's really taking off rapidly in other countries. So if we're going to benefit from the great science we've done in the UK, we need to be helping the UK companies, the small UK companies that are starting to use this, we need to be helping them to scale.
This is the classic UK problem, though, isn't it? We're really good at grassroots, getting things off the ground, and we are not good at scaling them, as you say. That has been a perennial problem, and many, many politicians and policymakers over many, many years have talked about it, but we never seem to solve it.
You're absolutely right. And this just seems to be such an exciting area where, if we can solve it, we can really make a difference. This is what, you know, a lot of our industries of the future will be based on. So, you know, if we want to really stimulate industry and economic growth in the UK, this is a chance that we've absolutely got to grab. And as our science minister, Lord Patrick Vallance, said, we've got in the UK a small but closing window to do that. And that's why we were publishing this report, why we did this inquiry now. We really want to say to the government, come on, you know, we've got to grab this window.
You spoke to many, many scientists, industrialists and so on in compiling this report. What did they tell you they need? In other words, what recommendations are you putting in the report to say to policymakers, this is the pain these people are suffering from and this is the panacea they need?
They need skills. We could do with more funding to get more people trained up in this area. But also, of course, rather than just losing people as we are at the moment in this area to the US and to Singapore and other places who are moving forward, we need also to be able to attract people in. So that means that we need more support for visas for scientists. We need the right regulatory environment. The regulatory environment for this is very complicated at the moment. The government has established the Regulatory Innovation Office. That needs to move really quickly to make the regulatory system simple so that small companies working in this area have a single point of contact into the regulatory system rather than a mass of potential different regulators, which is what they face at the moment. We need investment. We need things like the National Wealth Fund to be prepared to go in as a first investor and take risk, to crowd in other investors. And we need some pull as well to get those investors in, not just the government showing it's prepared to invest, but also the government helping with adoption. So we need government to be thinking how it can use public procurement, so things like the US BioPreferred program, but also policy, you know, things like the requirement to use a certain percentage of biofuels or sustainable aviation fuels that the aviation industry is now going to see, which is going to be gradually increasing year by year. Actually, if you could make that more specific to engineering biology derived fuels, or if there are other chances to use that sort of policy to pull through and create the market for these new processes, that's the other thing that's going to really help bring in investors.
Do you think the government will go for it?
I hope so. I mean, I think we've been really pleased with the impact our report has had. We are, of course, now waiting for a government response. We have Lord Vallance as our science minister. We have Dame Angela McLean as our government chief scientist. So we have already have some strong voices in government. We have a government which is in the process of producing an industrial strategy. So we hope we're highlighting at the right time this very exciting opportunity where we have these UK strengths, and we need to use them now.
Julia King, Baroness Brown of Cambridge there, who chairs the Lords Science and Technology Committee and foresees a window of opportunity, but one that is threatening to slam shut in our faces if we don't leap through it now.
The Naked Scientists podcast is produced in association with Spitfire, cost-effective voice, internet and IP engineering services for UK businesses. Find out how Spitfire can empower your company at spitfire.co.uk.
Music in the programme is sponsored by Epidemic Sound. Perfect music for audio and video productions.
This is the Naked Scientist podcast with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, could we be about to discover a new planet in our solar system? But first, a new study has found that the noble gas xenon can counteract some of the major hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. Now, this has only been demonstrated so far in mice engineered to develop an Alzheimer's-like pathology, as well as on cells grown in a culture dish, but it does look very interesting. Oleg Potofsky at Harvard's Brain Science Initiative has found that exposure to xenon boosts the activity of the brain's microglial cells. Now, these are a bit like litter pickers. They prowl around the brain clearing up rubbish. A burst of xenon gas seems to make them much more mobile, so they can migrate towards mess more quickly, and they do a better cleanup job in the process.
The question was whether we can use xenon gas, which is very rare gas in atmosphere, whether we can use this to modulate immune cells of the brain in a way they're going to be beneficial or reparative in Alzheimer's disease.
Why would a noble gas like xenon, A, get into the brain, and B, affect how cells in the brain work in the first place? What's the evidence that that's even possible?
So there's not much evidence, but historically, xenon has been tried in different things, including brain trauma, psychotic conditions, stuff like that. It is anesthetic gas. It actually has been approved in Europe to use it anesthesia, although they don't use it because of the cost. It's very, very expensive and rare gas, but it can be used for particular dosage to use it as anesthesia, that's all.
Tell us about the study you did then in Alzheimer's disease. You're doing this in mice. Now, mice don't naturally get Alzheimer's disease, so these must be mice that have been engineered in some way to develop something a bit like Alzheimer's.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So this is transgenic mice, which overexpress particular proteins, which is called amyloids or tau proteins, which are pathogenic in Alzheimer's. So once human age, these proteins start to aggregate and become toxic. This is how mice done. So they overexpress. They have high expression of these human proteins, and they start to develop some sign of pathology resembling to human AD brains. Although before moving to mice, we did some simple experiments to see whether xenon has any effect related to neurodegenerative condition. My lab many years ago developed this interesting experiment paradigm where we transplant that cell into a living mouse brain. And within hours, this immune cell called microglia, they migrate. They're coming close to the cells. They recognize some dying cells, migrate to the cells and phagocyte. And this is great to test anything, including xenon. Mice have been exposed once to xenon inhalation, about 40 minutes. Microglia affected in a way they very quickly migrate. They recognize these dying cells, phagocyte, and this is what they did. This was a trigger to us to move forward and to try now xenon inhalation in these Alzheimer's mouse models. They became more migratory, more phagocytic.
And what impact did that enhanced activity conferred on the microglia by the xenon treatment have on the Alzheimer's progression slash presentation in these mice?
So the fact, we start to look at whether we do see reduction in these amyloid plaques, and this is what we found. But as well, this was associated with reduction of so-called neuritic plaques. Those aggregates actually cause to neuronal death or synaptic loss. And then we find as well that xenon mitigates this pathological evidence. So this was great. As a future, moving forward, we'd like to see where xenon as well have effect on cognitive improvements. That's going to be very important in as a treatment for Alzheimer's.
It's an interesting observation, that, isn't it? Oleg Potofsky there from Harvard University. Planet X, which is often called Planet 9, is a hypothetical planetary body that some scientists believe exists out beyond Pluto and Neptune. Regular mathematical wobbles in the orbits of some of the distant bodies in our solar system point towards something that we can't account for, exerting a periodic gravitational tug on them. So, is there a giant planet out there? Here's Matt Bothwell, public astronomer at Cambridge University's Institute of Astronomy.
This sometimes gets called Planet X or Planet 9. Planet X meaning 10, of course, in Roman numerals, when we used to have Pluto. The idea of there being a mysterious, massive planet beyond the orbit of Pluto, that would have been the 10th planet. Since Pluto got kicked out of the Planet Club, now this mysterious planet that some people think might exist in the dark outer reaches of our solar system, if we find it, would be Planet 9. And that's the question. Is there a fairly massive planet that we haven't found yet lurking in the freezing darkness of the outer solar system?
Why do space scientists think there might be?
The best way of answering this is go back in time 250 years. Astronomers had just discovered the planet Uranus in 1781. And then in the decades following Uranus's discovery, astronomers noticed that it was speeding up and slowing down in ways that were hard to square with our understanding of how gravity worked. And the best explanation that we had is that there was another planet outside of the orbit of Uranus, and it was the gravity of this unseen planet pushing Uranus around. So mathematicians did some calculations, we pinpointed this planet, and it did exist. It turned out to be Neptune. So the way we found Neptune wasn't just because we spotted something in the sky and went, huh, that's funny. It's because we saw the planet Uranus, something that we knew existed, being pushed around by something invisible. And in short, that seems to be happening again. So where Pluto lives in the outskirts of the solar system, there's this whole population of what get called TNOs, for trans-Neptunian objects. And when you look at the orbits of all these different TNOs in the outer solar system, they sort of seem like they are being shepherded or herded by something massive that we haven't seen yet. All of their orbits seem to be lining up in a way that sort of goes beyond coincidence, but would make perfect sense if there's a missing planet out there.
How big would that have to be, that missing planet, in order to produce those effects?
Estimates vary, but at the very least, a few times the size of Earth, maybe even up to a Uranus or Neptune-style gas giant, ice giant.
And just one planet, or could there be a swarm of them out there? Can the maths resolve that?
I think our best guess is one so far, if only just because it's sort of the simplest explanation. Once we have some future telescopes that come online, we might get a better idea of exactly how these TNOs are behaving, and we'll be able to constrain it a bit better. But at the moment, one planet is our best guess.
And you've sort of anticipated my next question, which is going to be seeing it. So what's it going to take? How are we going to resolve this quandary?
Yeah, it's really tricky because in theory, there's nothing stopping us seeing this planet. The problem is we don't really know where it is. It's a bit more of a complicated problem than the astronomers were trying to solve when they found Neptune. Uranus was behaving quite sensibly, and we were able to pinpoint Neptune's position quite accurately. The TNOs that seem to be sort of lining up and swarming in this particular way are a bit more hard to pin down. And so the haystack that we are looking for our needle in is enormous, basically. And so we have a huge swath of sky that this thing could exist in, and it's likely to be incredibly small and faint. Luckily, we have a telescope coming online over the next year or so, which is going to be absolutely perfect for this, called the Vera Rubin Observatory. And the really amazing thing about Rubin is that it's doing something almost that no telescope has ever done before. Most telescopes are very, very powerful and look at very, very small patches of sky. So listeners might have come across the James Webb telescope. It's an incredibly powerful telescope. It can see right across the other side of the universe, but it looks at this astonishingly tiny little dot of sky. And if you were going to just scan the possible area where this planet could live with the James Webb telescope, it would take 1,000 years to find. Rubin, the Vera Rubin telescope, is going to be able to photograph the entire sky every few days down to this incredible level of faintness. And so if there is anything out there that is Planet 9, Vera Rubin will almost certainly find it.
Where is this amazing telescope, and when will it turn on?
So the telescope is in Chile and under some of the clearest skies in the world. And first light, which is what we call the telescope's first glimpse of the sky, is due this year in July 2025.
So we're going to find out some pretty good stuff pretty soon then. Obviously, it wasn't conceived in order to solve this problem. This is just something that might be amenable to looking at or being explored with this telescope, what's its primary purpose? What's it there to solve?
So it's going to be really good at what we call time domain astronomy, which basically is the astronomer's lingo for anything that is changing over time. So any kind of transient event, like an exploding star or a gamma ray burst or a black hole that's changing how fast it's gobbling up the dust and gas around it, anything that's rapidly changing in the sky, because Vera Rubin will photograph the entire sky every few days, will actually get to be able to make almost videos, if you like, right? So we will have that extra time components where we'll be able to see stars exploding and then fading away. We'll be able to see black holes growing and growing and growing as they gobble stuff in front of our eyes. Because it photographs the entire sky as well, we're also hoping it's going to make massive strides in our understanding of dark energy and dark matter, because it's going to be really good at making these enormously wide-scale maps of the cosmos, which is exactly what we need to understand our universe on the bigger scales and tell something about dark energy and dark matter.
And we'll keep an ear to the ground for what happens when the Vera Rubin Observatory goes live later this year. Lots of interesting things certainly in store from where that's based. That was Matt Bothwell. He's at the University of Cambridge. Now it's time for our question of the week, which this time is all about dreams, and it takes James Titko on a journey to snowy mountain peaks.
Hi, it's Andrew in Cambridge. We have a holiday home in a French ski resort at 1,650 metres above sea level, and everyone who visits experienced, I'm going to call them high-definition dreams, dreams with much more detail than they normally experience when they're in Cambridge. Does altitude affect dreams, and do mountaineers who go much higher notice the same effect?
Thanks, Andrew. You and your guests are not alone. Mountaineers have long reported vivid dreams at high altitudes, and there may well be a psychological component to this. Mountains have been a timeless source of mythological material, places where ancient gods or dragons reside. And for those of us who don't see it a lot, there's something magical and atmospheric about snowy landscapes. This heightened sensory experience could well be playing a part in those high-definition dreams. But there's almost certainly more to it than that. And it's worth focusing on the thinner, less oxygenated air at high altitudes to probe your question. Here to help me is Andrew Murray, Professor of Metabolic Physiology at the University of Cambridge.
Thanks, James. Sleep disturbances are very common at high altitude, particularly when we first arrive and are relatively unacclimatized. In a large part, this is caused by our erratic breathing patterns, which are most obvious at night when we surrender conscious control of our breathing. Essentially, there's a tussle going on between two different and somewhat opposing sensory mechanisms. One set of chemoreceptors in a cluster of cells called the carotid body pick up on low oxygen levels in our arterial blood and send signals to our brain urging us to breathe more rapidly to bring more oxygen into our lungs. So far, all very sensible, but breathing harder also means that we exhale more carbon dioxide, making our blood less acidic. A second set of chemoreceptors senses that our cerebral spinal fluid is getting progressively more alkaline and puts the ventilatory brakes on, causing our blood oxygen levels to fall again before the cycle continues. This is a well-known phenomenon called Chain-Stokes breathing and is also seen in patients with heart disease. At altitude, it's not uncommon to wake with a start following a period of apnea, complete cessation of breathing, and a feeling that we're suffocating. Of course, this can also be highly disruptive for the person that we're sharing a bed or a tent with.
This would explain why you might wake with a start during the first night spent at altitude. But why might this lead to more vivid dreams? Well, to answer that, we need to think about our brains during sleep. We're accustomed in healthy sleep to cycles of four progressing stages lasting about 2 hours in total, from light transitional sleep to deeper sleep, culminating in rapid eye movement or REM sleep.
Rapid eye movement sleep is when we do our vivid dreaming. So does this suggest that a greater proportion of our sleep at high altitude is in this lighter phase? Well, quite the opposite, in fact. When tested experimentally, investigators found that not only does overall sleep duration fall at altitude, but the proportion of our sleep, which is REM sleep, also falls. Instead, it may be that we are more susceptible to sudden waking during this relatively light sleep stage, cutting short our time spent in REM sleep, but enhancing recollection of our dreams in the process, perhaps because they are within touching distance of our waking consciousness.
There you have it, Andrew. I hope that answers your question. Thanks to Andrew Murray, Professor of Metabolic Physiology at the University of Cambridge, for helping us with the answer. Next time, we'll be answering this question from listener George. He writes, I used to chew a lot of gum, probably on average over a pack a day. I developed tinnitus a couple of years ago and was told nothing could be done. However, when I stopped chewing gum, my tinnitus stopped, and when I started chewing gum a lot again, it came back. Why might this be the case?
Well, we're sorry to hear that, George. Let's see if we can find an answer for you. In the meantime, if you know the answer, or you have a quandary of your own you're grappling with and you'd like us to take a look, please pen us a line. It's chris@thenakedscientist.com by email. You can also follow the discussions that we're having on our forum at nakedscientist.com/forum. There's a question of the week section there. Now, before we go, please let me remind you, we do rely very heavily on your donations to keep the Naked Scientist show on the road, and we're really grateful to those of you who do step up and help us. Thank you so much. But we do have some way to go. We have set a target, and we're about halfway there. So if you enjoy this programme each week and you appreciate the work that we do for you, please do give us a hand there by going to nakedscientist.com/donate. That's nakedscientist.com/donate. Donate, and we've made it very safe and secure. You can help us out on a one-time basis or even regularly. That's all we've got time for on this episode, but do join us on Tuesday coming up when we're going to look ahead to Burns Night with a very special show on the science of Scotch whisky. And believe me, it was terrifically interesting and very appetizing as a programme to make. The Naked Scientist comes to you from the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education. It is supported by Rolls-Royce. I'm Chris Smith. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Eine neue Form der Effizienz mit Asana. Erkennen Sie Hindernisse und halten Sie Ihre Projekte und Ziele auf Kurs. Kostenlos testen unter asana.com.